We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can unlock ad-free versions of the podcast for $3 a month and get bonus episodes on current TV, movies we don't cover on the podcast, and other topics for $5 a month. We recently released episodes on the FX series Shogun and the new Bertrand Bonello film, The Beast. And we have another one in the works on the Apple TV Plus documentary, Girl State. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with...
Tasha Robinson.
Keith Phipps.
And Genevieve Kosky.
Finally, after a decade together, almost a decade, doing this podcast, we're doing a pairing that involves a movie about tennis. And since there's four of us, that makes this a mixed doubles podcast. Anyway, I have a trivia question for you. Do you know... who was voted most improved player as a freshman on the Sprayberry High School men's varsity tennis team that went 3-7 in 1987?
Matt Damon.
I went so far as to look up the Sprayberry High School 1987 yearbook to find an answer to this trivia question. And I still don't know because it didn't include the tennis team. Scott, tell us.
It was me.
I'm just assuming it was. I think Matt Damon was more improved that year than you were. He's from Marietta, Georgia, isn't he?
No. Oh, well, see, you know it's from Marietta. You know, I was the pride of Marietta, Georgia. It was me. Yeah, so
I mean, I looked up Sprayberry High School.
Cobb County, right? We were right in the middle of Newt Gingrich's district, which is now Democratic, by the way. Anyway, so we were 3-7. I was a freshman, and I was voted most improved, which was basically an award given to the freshman who most good naturedly accepted the bullying of the upperclassmen. I have a plaque. I have the plaque for it still that I used to have at the dissolve offices, and I'm reasonably proud of it, though I was scared off of ever playing tennis again. So that's my exciting tennis story.
I'm just going to assume if they let Matt Damon play on that team that year, he would have improved more than you, about.
Oh, he definitely would have.
He's an up and comer.
Yes. So anybody else want to share any sporting triumphs while we're on the subject here?
I played team sports once after I was soccer when I was very little. I played team sports once. I was fifth grade basketball, and I got a basket once.
No. Oh. Okay.
In my high school, we had to take two different gym credits, two semesters worth of gym classes. And I somehow tricked them into letting me take combination rackets twice. So I took for my gym credit, I took the same class twice.
I recently went on the JoCo cruise and I came in third in a You Don't Know Jack classic tournament involving 50 people. That's like a sport, right? It's competitive. Yeah.
Wait, you were on a cruise since last we spoke?
Yes, I have been on a cruise. Well, maybe since last you and I spoke. We should take note of the fact, speaking of triumphs, even if not of the sports variety, this is the first time all four of us have been on this podcast together in quite a while.
Yeah. So we're going to make this opening as long and discursive as possible. And people are just going to have to deal with it.
We never talk to each other in any form other than this podcast ever, under any circumstances. Certainly not, a going away party for a good friend that happened recently or anything like that.
Wait, were you there?
I was not, in fact, there, okay. But I didn't right. understand what other people spirit. Were.
Yeah. We felt her there. So, all right, we'll reluctantly get down to the actual business at hand here.
It's been so long since we did our opening hijinks. We set a no hijinks rule a couple years back, and we've been slowly backsliding. Well, I think we're in full hijinks
no
mode
scripted
again.
Scripted hijinks. This was a more of a lightly prompted hijinks, which is fine.
Yeah, this isn't a skit.
No, but we'll backslide into those again. Genevieve, can you tell us about the films we'll be discussing over the next two episodes?
Sure. Luca Guadagnino's new film Challenger stars Zendaya as a tennis prodigy whose pivot into coaching after a career-ending injury puts her in a difficult spot, professionally and romantically. Her husband is a former tennis champion who seeks her help in plotting a comeback, but his main competition is a player who just happens to be her ex-lover and his former best friend. From her perspective, the match is love. Scott has scripted for me to pause for laughter in this moment.
Ah, good stuff.
He specifically meant his laughter at his own joke in his own script.
Yep. Moving on, this sexy love triangle with a woman at its center recalls Alfonso Cuarón's 2001 breakthrough film Y Tu Mama También, a lusty coming-of-age road movie about teenage boys who coax an older woman into striking out on an adventure with them while their girlfriends are in Italy. They get something close to the fantasy they concocted for themselves, but the journey reveals deeper truths about their friendship and her motivation.
So we'll start our pairing this week with the liberating rambunctiousness of Alfonso Cuarón's Y Tu Mama También before exchanging volleys next week over Luca Guadagnino's Challengers.
Uno. No hay honor más grande que ser un charolastra.
Dos, cada quien puede hacer de su culo un papalote.
Tres, pop mata poesía.
Cuatro, un toque al día, la llave de la alegría.
Bueno, se la propuso el sábado, hay que hacerle mucho caso.
Cinco, no te tirarás a la vieja de otro charolastra.
Seis, puto el que le vaya a la América.
Siete, que muera la moral y que viva la chaqueta.
Ocho, prohibido casarse con una virgen.
Nueve, puto el que le vaya a la América.
No, eso ya lo dijeron.
No, es que se repite porque es re puto el que le vaya a la América.
Que le va a la América, ¿no?
10, la neta es chida, pero inalcanzable.
¿Cómo?
O sea, que la verdad es lo mejor de lo mejor, pero puta, es dificilísimo de alcanzar.
Y 11. Pierde la calidad
de charolastra, que rompa con cualquiera de los puntos anteriores.
We tend to associate sexual liberation with political upheaval, as they seem like natural partners in the same fight against the forces of oppression, not to mention compatible sources of passion. But for Tenoch and Julio, the horny best friends in Alfonso Cuarón's Y Tu Mama También, the politics are mostly just background noise. Though he's the privileged son of a nationalist politician in Mexico City, Tenoch, played by Diego Luna, doesn't think about the upheaval facing the country in 1999 any further than opining that, quote-unquote, left-wing chicks are hot. When he and his working-class best friend Julio, played by Gael García Bernal, attend a lavish family wedding with the president of Mexico himself in attendance, they mostly see it as an opportunity to goof off and do a little skirt chasing, because their girlfriends have flown off to Italy on vacation. Tenoch and Julio are charismatic and handsome enough to mostly get what they want. At the party, they do a full-court press on Luisa, played by Maribel Verdú, the hot Spanish wife of Tenoch's pretentious cousin, Yano. The friends half-jokingly improvise an invitation to Luisa to head out on the road and visit a secluded beach called Heaven's Mouth, with no realistic expectation that she'll want to come along. But when Yano calls Luisa and tearfully confesses to having an affair, Luisa surprises the boys by agreeing to join them on the trip. On short notice, they consult their stoner buddy on a route that could lead to a beach that could pass off as Heaven's Mouth, and Julio takes a beat-up station wagon under an agreement with his politically active sister, who will let him have it for 5 days if she can use it for 3 weeks to deliver supplies to Chiapas. Such is their contrast in priorities. There's a powerful foreground-background dynamic that plays out in Y Tu Mama También, owing to the charismatic solipsism of teenagers who spend 99% of their time thinking about getting laid and the other 1% achieving some sort of gratification, whether through quickies or through their own hands. The tensions within the country and the immense poverty they witness along the way are just background noise to them, something to pass through on the journey to their fake beach. We notice the checkpoints and the tense interactions between the locals and armed men, but they're just breezing past, sometimes by leaving a few coins to keep them from getting harassed. Cuarón doesn't take a judgmental tone necessarily, but he does suggest that emotional growth and political consciousness often happen on different timelines. As for the foreground part, Itamama Tambien is remarkable in its sexual candor, right from the opening shot of Tenoch having one last roll in the hay with his girlfriend, making her promise not to cheat on him with Italians or gringo backpackers or anyone else she encounters overseas. We discover his hypocrisy later in the film on this front. We also discover Julio's too. They've both had sex with each other's girlfriends, and they eventually have sex with Luisa too, albeit on her terms. Tenoch and Julio's flagrant violation of their own bro codes knocks the trip off balance in a way that Luisa tries to fix, but there's another tension between them that she triggers and cannot resolve. There are so many elements here that make Itamama Tambien special, from the spontaneous beauty of Emmanuel Lubezki's photography to the omniscient voiceover narration, which offers insight into the characters at times and context with a political wave about to crash over their country. It's a wild rollercoaster ride up and down the Kinsey scale, and a sober treatment of a friendship torn asunder by subtle class differences and major betrayals. And for all the sobering events that happen, it still feels like an exhilarating adventure. We'll get into it after the break.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
¡Iros a tomar por culo la mierda!
¡Vete a la verga!
¡Qué gilipollas! Pensé que erais distintos, pero sois las mismas bestias. ¡Qué manifiesto ni qué charolastras de mierda! Si ni siquiera respetáis vuestros propios mandamientos. Como todos los tíos, marcando territorio y dándoos de hostias cuando lo único que os gustaría sería follar el uno con el otro. ¡Eso es lo que os gustaría! ¿Qué más da si os habéis acostado con la novia del otro? ¿Qué más da, coño, con lo rápido que os corréis los dos? ¡Mierda! ¿Quién me manda, coño? Críate con críos y limpia las pañales.
So I talk about it in my keynote, but one of the most dynamic elements of this film is the relationship between the sexual hijinks in the foreground and the political unrest in the background. How do you feel the film manages those? That's kind of a huge question, but let's try to get into it here.
I mean, I do kind of love a movie that assumes that either we're from the country in question or that we're going to do our research or you know, that we just know a great deal about world history. I think it's really interesting how little explanation or detail we get here about what's going on in the backdrop. We just see these two boys, you know, roaming around the country together, talking a great deal about their dicks and their sex life. And in the background, we have, you know, people coming up to them begging for money or like people being arrested en masse. And there's just the kind of ongoing like, oh, no, we're going to be fine. Us in our car, like we're not going to get questioned and arrested for very little reason. Just don't make eye contact with the soldiers at any point. And that kind of ongoing tension between, you know, serious things are happening and people are suffering and the kind of like privilege that the three leads are enjoying and then kind of the pain that they're enjoying at the same time. You know, they're going through some pretty momentous things personally in terms of their relationships, but there are much more momentous things happening all around them. And it's, I kind of love the contrast, the sort of reminder that no matter what you're caught up in emotionally, there are people that are worse off than you. And it kind of seems like that's part of the tension here, is that all of the things these three people are going through in their various and separate relationships with each other are monumental life-changing moments for them, but they're also just like so small compared to everything going on around them in their country. And I think that that's, in that very uncommented on, unforced way, is just a really kind of salient and interesting lesson.
It's interesting to hear you characterize what's going on in the lives of, especially Tenoch and Julio, as like big and life-changing, because like by the end of the movie, it is like a life-changing experience for them. But like in the moment, it all just feels so like short-sighted and petty in that way that youth can often be, you know? And for a lot of the movies, sort of the way that it deals with the sort of the bigger picture of what's happening in Mexico, you know, with the, sort of the way the sound drops out and the narrator pops in and, you know, we get a sort of a little vignette, I guess, of what's happening outside them. It just, it really kind of highlights sort of the blinkeredness of these two boys, you know, and how kind of how frivolous their lives are in this exact moment in comparison to what's, you know, like we said, going on around them. But also, like, within sort of the bigger political upheaval of the time, we also get these, again, vignettes of sort of other individuals and other individual stories playing out. The one that always sticks out to me is the fisherman, Chewy. And at the end where the narrator comes in to tell us like what happens to him in the ensuing months and years, and he'll never fish again. And it's so sad. You know, it's not just like placing their personal dramas against the backdrop of like big political upheaval. It's like contrasting them with other personal dramas that are different from theirs too. And again, it all just sort of highlights the sort of blinkeredness of the experience that they are having.
Another thing to consider is that, you know, for the audience of Mexican moviegoers in 2001, the politics wouldn't have been obscure. They would have been of the moment. I mean, one of the models for this film was starred specifically masculine, feminine, which was, you know, now looks like it's such a period piece that captures France's particular moment in the 60s. But then it was sort of like, you know, a dispatch from, you know, a news dispatch. And when this came out in Mexico, there was a whole, I don't know all the details of it, but there's a controversy over the rating, which allowed no one under 18 with or without their parents to go see the movie. And I think Caron took this as, in some ways, as politically motivated because it is, you know, critical of the status quo in many ways.
It's interesting that he would see it that way, as opposed to the fact that this movie literally begins with two people locked in a rather passionate and relatively graphic naked embrace. I mean, this is a movie with a lot of simulated sex and a lot of skin. And, you know, a movie flirting around the edges of queerness in a way that was not common for films at the time. It's also just a film where people are talking graphically about sex almost constantly. So the idea that he would feel that there was a political motive for giving it the equivalent of an R rating is a little interesting to me.
Not R, it's X though.
Not letting anyone in 18 or under without
Fair.
A guardian is definitely pretty harsh.
No, with it doesn't matter.
That's what I'm saying.
Go with a guardian.
Yeah.
Sure. NC-17 then, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, it would be like that, which is a killer here in the States. I mean, like that rating never really worked. You know, and this is another thing I said in the keynote, but one of the things I really admire about the movie is that I think we do have this association with kind of sexual liberation and political awakening being two things that happen together. And I guess that's maybe it happens almost on a college level. If you look at a film like Dreamers or something by Bertolucci, it's kind of, you know, it's those two things happening at once. And, you know, it feels kind of non-judgmental and almost well observed about, you know, just the solipsism of youth that these boys are not really mature enough to be engaged or interested in what's happening around them other than the pursuit of their own pleasure. You know, they're entirely focused on that. And it makes for really interesting, ironic moments. But I never feel like the film is like necessarily critical of them or trying to like scold them for it. It's just kind of like, there's just kind of an irony to all of it, that all of this stuff is happening and they're oblivious to it.
I mean, it just kind of feels like it's inviting us as the audience to look back on youth as kind of a time of callowness and shallowness and maybe fun. You know, there is a kind of innocence to the way they pursue pleasure, just like so hedonistically and so unrepentantly and so hypocritically, you know, with just absolutely no awareness of their own unfairness, I guess, in what they consider fair and unfair in the pursuit of getting laid, and their obliviousness to what's going on around them and to how their country is treating other people and to what effect it has just kind of on the shape of the nation is kind of part of the story, where we're not quite laughing at them, but we are, I think, meant to look at them mostly with a slightly more jaded eye, like a slightly more mature eye. And, you know, it might be fun to be like this reckless and this oblivious and this young and this pretty, but it's not a nostalgia piece. You know, it's not a God, I wish I could go back to college kind of thing, because there is a certain remove from them, I think, that is suggested for anybody with any empathy. I guess, for people living through tumultuous times without the protection that these two boys seem to enjoy.
There's a sort of a retrospective documentary about this on the Blu-ray from 2014, where there's a lot of interviews with Cuarón and his brother Carlos Cuarón, who co-wrote the script with them. And I forget which one of them says, but so they're glad they didn't make it when they were younger, that they had a little distance from this time period where they can kind of look at it, assess it a little more with grown-up eyes.
So I'm kind of curious, I mean, just to get it, I wanted to just ask you all about the central relationship between these boys, the nature of their friendship. Two aspects interest me in particular. One is, you know, how important do you feel their class differences is in that relationship? And then what do you make, I guess, of these kind of hidden tensions between them that kind of come out eventually in the end?
I think the class difference is something that they're trying to ignore. And then, you know, the film is at least partially about them reaching a point in life where they can't ignore it anymore. I mean, we can talk about, you know, why they don't talk to each other after this trip they take together, I'm sure. But I mean, it seems like in some ways, this trip may have just hastened the inevitable, that they're going to go their different ways because they're from different, you know, strata of society.
Is it that they can't ignore the differences anymore, though, or is it that they come to a point they're kind of deliberately backgrounding those things in favor of enjoying all of the things they have in common? But as soon as they want to hurt each other, that's one of the things that they reach for, is contempt over that break. You know, as soon as something comes between them and they need weapons, that's one of the weapons they both reach for, is the class difference and like which one of them therefore is more privileged and which is more authentic and to what degree, you know, one of them might be a phony or the other might be a peasant. You know, these words that they throw at each other trying to hurt each other. It's certainly something that, you know, for all of the pretense, it's in the background and they are aware of it. They can just ignore it most of the time. But I think the rapidity with which they reach for that idea as soon as they need a weapon is pretty telling.
Yeah, it comes out in the one big fight that they have with each other, where Tanakh calls Julio like a peasant or something like that.
I think he calls him a hick. At least that's what my subtitles
something
had.
Like that.
Yeah. I feel like so much of the economic imbalance stuff is put so much more on the character of Tenoch than Julio. Like, we do get, you know, some background on Julio, but like it's a really interesting through line on Tenoch's character throughout. And there's just so many like little subtle moments. Well, there's the scene where they're driving, the narrator talks about driving through his maid's hometown, and him not saying anything about it. But that's obviously not that subtle, because none of those narration bits are subtle. But I was thinking of like sort of, there's a point where the narrator gives us the little detail about how Tenoch would always use his foot to lift the lid on the toilet at Julio's home. And then when they're like stopped at a bar at one of the first night, we see him lift the toilet seat with his foot in this grungy bar, like right after kind of wordlessly giving money to a beggar or a man begging, you know. And it's just like there's all these sort of indications that Tenoch like is aware of how you're supposed to behave with privilege, but also he has internalized that privilege in a way that like he naturally kind of looks down on other people. And then just sort of the grace note of him at the end saying that he is in fact going into studying economics after at the beginning, you know, wanting to be a writer and like resisting his father's desire for him to study economics and ending up just kind of backsliding, I guess, into that expectation for him. I just feel like there's sort of a lot more of an arc, I guess, with Tenoch's character, or we just don't get quite as much information about Julio in that regard.
I mean, you do get that information in the beginning about Julio's family, right? And mm-hmm. and about his mother who's working to support the entire family, about his sister who's a bit of an activist. I mean, like, some of that stuff kind of comes out, and it feels it definitely feels like the impression there with both of his family members is a little more groundedness in certain economic realities and political realities than his friend, who is a part of a political family, doesn't have, because he doesn't need to. You know, he can kind of exist. He can kind of allow that stuff to be in the background. You know, you get to that, with that wedding, it's like the he doesn't care that the president, neither one of them care that the president of Mexico is there. They just want to hit on Luisa. I think that stuff is fascinating. You know, and then I guess we you know, get this, you know, other pretty, you know, all the politics and class differences aside, we also have these sexual tension between these friends that comes out in a pretty big way at the end. And then I think you would have to say contributes quite a bit to the dissolution of their friendship. You know, I think even more so than other pages they might have turned in their lives. It just seems to, like, there was some line that was crossed and they can't really seem to contend with what that is, and so they just let it go completely.
Yeah, agreed. Getting back to the kind of economic tension and how we see it in the movie, one of the things that struck me most, I guess, on this rewatch is seeing how they both live. You know, it seems like it takes a little while to see Julio's home life and how it compares with Tenoch's home life, which we see very early on. But when we get that glimpse of him, like, moving through the living room of the apartment where his family lives and seeing out the window and realizing that it's kind of like a high-rise tenement that looks, you know, almost like a housing project, basically. We don't see a ton of the apartment itself. We just see, you know, what the view that he sees every day looks like. And, you know, it's still very, like, fine city living compared to some of the rural areas that we pass through in this movie, where the buildings are just these, like, kind of ancient looking rundown concrete structures. I was very curious at times to know sort of the history of some of the places that they were moving through that seemed to be abandoned, yet modern, you know, single story concrete buildings just, like, out in the middle of what seems like nowhere. But then, you know, some very small villages as well. So, you know, we're kind of seeing at least three different tiers of wealth and privilege, and again, mostly uncommented on, which kind of makes it all the more interesting because you really have to kind of, like, be dialed into it and watching every detail to see kind of the range of lifestyles that we're experiencing in this movie.
I mean, I think that's kind of just the pleasure of this movie, which I think is just, I mean, a great movie. I don't think anyone's really talked about how we feel about this movie, but, you know, the greatness of this film is, like, it's just so arresting constantly. The foreground and the background part of this movie, the way they are separately and together, the performances are all star-making, basically. I mean, the two young actors, obviously, Diego Luna and Gael García Bernal, are still stars. You know, the photography by Emmanuel Lubezki is just, you know, gives you this such a vivid feel for both the sort of documentary aspects of the political backdrop and also just the look of the countryside and some of the kind of beauty and also the more desperate areas in the country. I mean, all that stuff, it comes through so vividly. It's such a lively film. The dialogue is exciting. It's, you know, it's sexy in its way. I mean, I think it's just a great movie. So I just want to come out and say that.
After seeing these actors for, you know, decades and seeing them, you know, mature into these very complicated and rich roles, it is so wild to see them so young and just so clearly in roles that don't kind of anticipate dignified stardom. You know, they're both getting naked and, again, literally comparing dicks. They're both kind of making fools of themselves in love, just like the sloppiest and kind of cutest young person ways. There's, like, an egolessness to these performances that just very much says, you know, young upcoming actor that doesn't have, like, a brand to manage or, like, an expectation of a genre to maintain. They're just, I mean, you could just say it's literally all out there with these two boys. It's very, they both feel very unfettered.
Yeah, rewatching it was slightly disorienting for me, especially seeing the two of them look so young, because I'll come out and say this was a very formative movie for me. I saw it when I was 17 for the first time, and I had a Gael García Bernal, like, backdrop on my computer all through college. As a result, it was definitely a crush-making movie for me back then.
This feels like the first step on a slippery slope that ends with you hosting a movie podcast, you know?
Yes, among other things. But I definitely had like rewatched it after that first time, but it's been a long time. And this is like the first time I've watched it like as a grown ass woman looking at these two boys that I lusted over as a younger woman. So and seeing how silly they look now is, like I said, a little disorienting, but still a great movie.
What you're saying is that you keep getting older and they stay the same age.
Yep. It did give me a little bit of that feeling.
So let's talk about Louisa, because I think if I'm being if I were to be cynical about the film, you could talk about her as sort of a narrative device. I mean, she comes in, she shakes things up between these boys, and then she goes off because her home planet needs her or something. We find out that she has later that she has cancer. She disappears from the narrative. We discover she's dead, and then she's the one who has kind of delivered these boys to a certain place. I mean, I'm not going to be the person who has that cynical view, but I want to know is what you think of her as a character of her own sort of individual integrity, and then what is kind of motivating her here?
Well, I'd say, let's say you did have that cynical view of the film. But here's the thing. I feel like that's a lot easier to leave the movie thinking about after seeing it the first time than on rewatches, where when you follow her character and you realize how much of it is her story, how differently you view that character when you know that she's dying. And we know that
doctor's office visit and the magazine quiz, like all of that just like hits so hard this time. It's like, mm-hmm. it's right there from the beginning, you know, and like all her crying that you're meant to think it's about, man, what's his name?
Jono or Jocko?
You're meant to think it's about Jono, but but no, like the part like that got me so hard this time is when they're on at Heaven's Mouth, the beach with Chewie and his family, and she's playing with the kids, and his wife says, you know, you're so good with children, geez. And you're the right and you're the right age to have them, and just like the look on her face, and like, you know, if you don't know what's really going on with her at that time, it's like, oh, just it's a little interaction. But if you know, it's like, oh, that's devastating, you know, and there's just this thread of devastation that follows her character. And like you said, Keith, like if you know it's there and you're following it, like I think there is a lot to that character, but it is maybe like a first watch issue feeling. But I want to hear Tasha's reasons, because you have seen this before.
Yeah, I think the ending of this movie, just as far as Louisa goes, is just total BS. It's just as you say, it is foreshadowed, it is threaded throughout, but I don't know. I had a good friend in college who wrote plays that I was really impressed with for the most part, but every single one of them ended with a character coming out on stage and like narrating, oh, and then by the way, this character like did something very slightly wrong and then died tragically. And they all ended with a monologue that was basically Poochie went back to his home planet and died on the way. And it always just struck me as a note of immaturity. One of the strengths of this movie for me, one of the things that makes it so interesting, and one of the things that I think the writer of Challengers really picked up on, is that you can look at the relationship between any two characters in the little triumvirate in this movie, and it's interesting and nuanced. And you look at the relationship between Louisa and these two boys as kind of a unit, and it's interesting and nuanced. And the way the ending just kind of like discards her off screen with a monologue, I think is ridiculous. But like on top of that, you know, I've seen people through cancer, both fatally and as survivors, and somebody 2 weeks out of dying of cancer that has riddled their entire body shows signs of it. You know, they don't go running around, you know, topless on the beach looking the picture of health and then just keel over of cancer 2 weeks later. And the myth of died beautifully of an unknown disease, like 2 weeks after this story for some cheap pathos, is a thing that I've seen in a number of films that I considered ridiculous. And here I just don't buy it. You know, that moment with the child is very sweet. Her reaction to her husband's infidelity is touching. but she was dying of cancer all along. If the movie revealed that she died of cancer like 3 years later and they had all been out of touch that long, I would have accepted it. But the way it's just kind of like thrown out as something that you're meant to accept is a big moment of, oh, and we didn't know all along. No, I don't buy it. I think it's silly. And, you know, just a weird, not very good grace note on top of a movie that's so interesting and thoughtful about character and about her character in particular as this complicated woman dealing with conflicting desires and sometimes very petty and immature desires and other times like more mature desires that kind of put her at odds with these much younger boys that she's taken up with. You know, there's a lot going on here. And as I say, to kind of like throw her away in some dialogue, she gets fridged. You know, she gets casually killed in order to make the boys have feels.
I hear you, but I just doesn't play that way for me. It plays more. I mean, just the narration in this film, I find just completely heartbreaking, and including the delivery of that news.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can't disagree with your point about just like the timeline element of it all. Like, sure, yes. But I think like, I don't think it's fridging her. I think it's making this her story after making us think it's these boys' story. Like, especially like on this rewatch, like, and again, like from that doctor's office scene onward, especially like the line of like, the magazine telling, like Tess saying she's afraid of claiming her freedom and she disagrees. It's like, that is the moment that sets this entire narrative in motion. Like this whole story is her claiming her freedom while she still has the time. And these two boys are just along for the ride. And I can see finding the way that it reveals this at the end inelegant. But again, I think like as a whole, you know, when you can see how it is threaded through, it just, I think it earns it.
Yeah, and I think it would be a mistake. It certainly would have been a mistake to have any kind of indications of her being like a faint cough or something.
just coughing a little blood into a handkerchief.
Exactly. It's like, oh boy, here we go. Yeah. So then you at least reach, I mean, you talked about second viewing, but you could still, even on first viewing, start to think back about all the things that had happened in the movie from her perspective and start to kind of think about how they figure into her motives for even going on this trip and for how she interacts with with these boys and what she kind of wants out of it. You know, I mean, this is, you know, she's doing something that she wants and she makes demands and she also responds to them in interesting ways and empathetic ways that are amusingly do not work out. But you know, when it's like, oh, I've got to redress the balance by sleeping with the other one, and doesn't really work. But
I mean, I think it also aligns with what we were talking about at the beginning of these two young boys not really being able to perceive the bigger picture of, or you're even just the other sort of human stories around them, because they're so wrapped up in their own little lives and dramas. And like, they, throughout this whole experience, they never really question why this is happening, like why she changed her mind or why she's behaving this way, you know. And they just like kind of like can't believe their own luck, basically, that they, you know, because it doesn't occur to them to think that like maybe something is going on with her that is prompting all of this. So I think it just like kind of adds another layer to that, like you said, Scott, the solipsism of youth. You know, I guess like what I like about the way it's revealed at the end is that it does make you, or at least makes me, realize, like I said, that this was her story all along. And that was, you know, the guys were just a fucking distraction, literally.
I know. I super don't buy it. If you want to make a movie somebody's story, you focus in on them. You don't discard them entirely in the final sequence and tell us that they died off screen somewhere. I mean, I'm going to go back to...
I don't need to see her die. I mean, I we get that, like, the shot of her at the jukebox, like, dancing toward the camera. Like, that, I feel, is her send-off, kind of, you know? Just that engagement with her in that moment. We're seeing her, we're looking at her in a way that we haven't throughout the film. I don't know. We can agree to disagree, but I don't want to see her dying in a hospital either.
For her to kind of stay behind in this sort of paradise of sorts, in this fairly peaceful place.
And Heaven's Mouth,
which actually exists, is kind of amazing.
It's not that I need to see her die, Genevieve. It's that I didn't think she needed to die at all. Like, everything that you're saying, I think, is true. As far as the boys not quite questioning why this is all happening, not necessarily seeing her as a person, taking it all for granted, and then, you know, focusing in on their own tensions. But there are just, you know, so many other things that have, could have happened in the end to bring them into a new maturity, apart from her, as I say, dying to give them feels. I just, it's just, it's such a trope. It's such an old, boring trope. I don't like it, and I don't particularly like the way it's handled here.
Okay, so yeah, I want to get into the two big scenes towards the end, which are connected and both two of the most memorable scenes in the movie. I mean, one is kind of the drunken threesome that they end up having in the conversation, you know, which starts with this very frank conversation at the bar, which is just beautifully written and really raucous, and then you know, ends with this, you know, sexual encounter in which the two friends are sort of brought together and kind of resolve certain tensions that had been simmering the whole time. And then the other scene I wanted to talk about is that scene at the end where they meet again, having changed enormously, and then we're told, you know, never see each other again. So I kind of wanted to get your take on this section of the film and how it all sort of works together.
Can I just shout out whoever handled like the personal styling and clothing for that last scene in particular? You know, the changes in them are so small in terms of how they're now dressed and their hairstyles. And yet they both look like 5 to 10 years older. Mm-hmm. We know it hasn't even been that long. It's just such a clear way of showing, you know, that they've been through something and they're carrying themselves differently. They're thinking about themselves differently. And it's amazing how different they both feel as people. Part of that is acting. Part of that is presentation. Part of that is the dialogue. But a lot of it is just in, you know, seeing Julio without that like unruly floppy hair and seeing both of them just kind of with different expressions on their face. I think it's fascinating how believable
it's Julio
it
who
is.
Has a terrible ponytail in the final scene there, right?
Yes.
It's he's working on it. It's going to be a ponytail someday.
Yeah.
But I feel like we are dancing around the threesome scene. because they don't know what to do with it. Like, we're told, the narrator tells us, you know, it's a silent and uneventful trip home. Like they never discuss it. So maybe it's appropriate that we're not really discussing it in depth either.
We're saving it. We're building up to it. All this tension's been mounting. Okay. Now we're actually going to talk about it.
All right. Well, go ahead.
I'll tell you what I think. I think it's not. I do not think this is a movie about two people who don't recognize that they're gay and realize that they're gay. I think the sexual attraction for each other is there, but I think it's more, I think what's going on there is more complex than just that. I think that'd be an oversimplified reading of this film.
I agreed. And I think I read it that way on first viewing in 2001. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just because I've seen so many more like actual queer stories since then that, you know, this just plays very differently. But no, I feel like they kind of get caught up in the moment. And I, like the rest of the film does not play like these are two like closeted kids trying to pretend that they like women and then finally getting a chance to act on what they both have wanted all along, that being men as opposed to each other. It feels like they're experimenting with something in the moment that they have kind of been dancing around this whole time.
It seems like they build to this moment of like ultimate freedom where they can say anything they want to each other. Like, you know, I had sex with your mother. That's funny. And do anything with each other. And like that passes, you know, maybe they're not equipped to have that much freedom. Maybe human beings aren't equipped to stay in that moment forever or even longer than a night. But you know, in that moment, it's everything's up for grabs. I mean, literally, but also just, you know, just symbolically as well.
You know, I also, on first viewing, back when it came out, took it as Louisa recognizing that. Like, she does come out and say, why don't you just, you know, mm-hmm. have sex with each mm-hmm. other? That's what you really want. And I took that act at the end as her drawing the two of them together on purpose. I'm not nearly as sure now. Like, I feel like she gives them that space, but I'm not sure that the act she's engaging in is expressly meant to get them to acknowledge anything or to touch each other. It feels like, as you say, kind of a moment of liberation for everyone that happens. And the fact that we instantly cut away from it and kind of don't see where it goes, especially compared with the sex acts that she commits with the two of them and the sticky, awkward aftermaths for both of them. It just seems very telling, you know, that we see so little of what that meant to any of them, apart from being told that they stopped speaking to each other at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the, like, waking up and immediately vomiting thing, which, you know, we could, you know, attribute at least in part, if not mainly, to all the drinking they had done. Mm-hmm. But I think there is, you know, also sort of an insinuation of just being, like, horrified at the realization that they woke up in bed together, which is maybe a little bit of a sour note to watch today. But like I said, I think you can kind of write it off as just the after effects of the alcohol more than any sort of disgust at what they did, more of sort of shock combined with the effects of alcohol.
But, I mean, in their more sober moments, I think they would be the type of dudes who would understand, you know, sexual attraction is a binary thing, and mm-hmm. and they get to this state with the drinking, with the camaraderie they have with each other, and also with Louisa, just this moment in which that line, you know, blurs, and they just kind of fall into this situation that, you know, in the cold light of day, they're filled with a certain amount of regret. I mean, all that feels very real, you know. Both things feel real. It feels real that this is a tension that's long existed between them that is being realized in this moment, and it feels real that they would have those regrets as well, and that might you know, be one of the things that keeps them from being friends in the future.
Threaded through the whole film is kind of a, you know, the tension around, like, playfully talking about their dicks and their bodies and their sex lives, and reinforcing, you know, heteronormativity. Like, they use the word fag a lot when talking about other people or other people's behavior when they aren't actually talking about their gay friend who comes up a bunch. And they seem pretty open-minded about him.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little tension there, but, like, they don't spend a lot of time calling him a fag. They just kind of generally talk about, you know, fag, like, as a general word for, like, things that they disapprove of. And then in that final sequence at the end, when they're having the more mature conversation, like, they bring up their gay friend again and, like, agree that, okay, yeah, he has a boyfriend and he's settled down and he's acting very effeminate. And that's cool. Like, good for him. They kind of, like, let go of that, you know, grab ass teenager. We have to constantly no homo everything to make it clear that we're not gay, you know, even though we're masturbating together competitively or showering together and then comparing penises, or, you know, all of these things that they're constantly doing in this cloud of sex that they operate in. They keep having to remind each other that they're not gay. And then, you know, eventually they seem to grow out of that.
You know what I'm not doing the morning after all that? I'm not going to eat shrimp soup. That's clearly not going to happen.
I mean, you want to get something in you with some fluid in it. That was my first thought.
Well, on that note, there's some other things that I really want to bring up in relation to Y Tu Mamá También, including the explicitness of it, but that's also something we can save for our next show on Challengers, because that's one of many things they have in common. But for now, we'll tap out and have some feedback. Now it's time for feedback, but before we get into it, we want to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's mothership podcast hosted by Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. As we record this, the boys are planning to talk about the 1999 version of The Mummy, which people of a certain generation really seem to love. And they also dig into the fifth film in their William Wyler series, Funny Girl. So I got to ask, what's the deal with The Mummy? Why do people, Genevieve, enlighten us. You're of that generation. Like, why do people think this thing is so great?
I don't know. I haven't watched it since it came out. I'm not mummy pilled. I'm sorry.
It's just one of those things that's just become like if you meet somebody who is just crazy about The Mummy, it's like, yeah. I know how old you are. I know what deals with you. So I'm just curious for some insight in that. And I think I can't make any promises, but by about the time this episode drops, I may be discovering this for myself for a piece in the reveal, because I have to know why this film that came out in 1999, you know, which a film that a year that everybody considers one of the great, you know, film years that we've had in the last, you know, 30 years or so, why The Mummy just keeps coming up. You know, I don't get it.
I'm not a Mummy super fan, but it sure doesn't surprise me. I mean, I think for a certain generation, it's the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a like quick moving, funny, world spanning adventure that ends up in the desert that involves like some romantic tension and some fighting some really, really bad guys and some quipping and like a very handsome leading man who has like a lot of sparks and a handful of comfortably safe but entertaining ethnic people that you can kind of keep at a distance from the central white characters, but also like draw on in a comfortable way. Like, it just, all of these dynamics, it's missing Nazis, but instead okay. It's got kind of like supernatural fantasy. It's got some good gags. It was also, you know, I still remember the waves of Beatles in that movie. As maybe one of the first all CG effects that I saw on screen that I thought, hey, that's kind of creepy and convincing, as opposed to a little forced and artificial. Like, I think it was a watershed movie for people of the right age and the right era.
I'll discover it. I mean, I thought that we had Romancing the Stone to hold the little SOBs, but. But I guess The Mummy was a thing.
Wait, it wasn't Romancing the Stone.
Romancing the Stone is like a decade earlier.
I know, but it did. But it's good enough.
I think The Mummy also was one of those that played on cable a lot. I think it was a weekend cable mainstay for a long time, which may have helped with some imprinting for a lot of people.
Imprinting, I like it.
Almost 15 years earlier, Scott.
All right,
there was quite the gap there.
Oh man, I'm getting killed here. All right, I'm getting on to feedback. I'm gonna move on to feedback. I don't know what you people are doing. Actually, I'm the one who got us into this. I shouldn't complain. As for feedback, we always like it when our listeners write in about anything film-related or call in. You can call in. As expected, we got plenty of responses to our discussion of Alex Garland's Civil War. Though a warning for listeners up front, there are major spoilers for the end of the movie in this email. So if you have not seen it, you may want to, not listen to this episode any longer and maybe catch us on the other side.
Do that 15-second button, a few times until you stop hearing
spoilers.
That's right.
So this email is from Anil. Genevieve, do you want to read it?
Sure. Anil writes, loved your discussion about Civil War and loved the movie too. I liked how Kirsten Dunst's character was in her own doomsday melancholia mode from the very first minutes of the film, and that there was a sense of Greek tragedy knowing that her PTSD would eat her up and that she would be replaced by a younger version of herself. To me, that made the film very timeless. I've met war journalists and thought her performance and the weight she carried were spot on. I also found the excitement and ruthlessness with which Kaylee Spani's character took that last photo of Lee's death very intriguing, as it was both tragic and disturbing at the same time. It reminded me a bit of the ruthlessness of how Keira Knightley's character in Never Let Me Go got disposed of. Ooh, double spoiler.
Get hit by a stray.
Back to Anil, whose question is, I was wondering if the conversation around the film would be different if it had been, for example, based on a well-known 1987 dystopian short story of the same name, in which the author imagined a group of journalists traveling through a dystopian civil war in a fictional country. Is there a double standard when we talk about adaptations versus original fictional screenplays? I found it refreshing to watch a movie that worked like a great short story, with the actual civil war being both a very specific and metaphorical thing as part of a dystopian fantasy. Do we really need more context than an idea or a fantasy whenever we watch a movie?
I love this question because I think it kind of cuts to the heart of a lot of the debate around Civil War. Just stepping back away from that big question, because I think that's what we're mostly going to talk about before we move on. I do want to agree that the moment where Jesse takes the picture of Lee is just so key to the movie. And I just wrote a big essay that should have been up about 2 weeks ago at the point where this drops, about the contrast between how Lee deals with a picture of a friend of hers dying to save her life and how Jesse handles it, and why that's such a thing in this movie, why it's such a part of the theme. I think that ending is just really, really spot on and a fascinating thing. But anybody else have thoughts on the rest of this letter before we get into the big question?
I some more thoughts on that. Not to engage with your essay without having reading it or really knowing what your thesis is. But do you feel like a younger Lee would have not deleted that photo and would have just behaved just like Jesse did?
Yes, absolutely. And okay.
I don't need to read your essay now. That's fine.
I think that's supposition, but pretty much all we know about younger Lee is that, she's won all sorts of awards and been all over the world and is a big name in the field. And I don't think you get there if you're, if you're afraid of taking the picture and keeping the picture and selling the picture. I also don't think that younger Lee was maybe quite so weary about having seen so much death, especially of people she cared about. But yeah, my guess would be she keeps that picture and publishes it.
Oh, as just a little note here, we talked about Never Let Me Go gets mentioned, I think, in this letter because that was scripted. That film was scripted by Alex Garland. So I think Anil was kind of making the connection between those two films based on that. He did not direct Never Let Me Go, but he wrote it based on Kazuo Ishiguro's book. I guess they're pals anyway. But the Civil War thing is fascinating. I mean, I did a kind of a deep dive on how Civil War sort of links up with earlier Garland films that are quite similar to it. I mean, we talked about 28 Days Later in the last podcast, and Never Let Me Go is mentioned in the essay as well as Dread. And I think there's, I think in those films you can kind of see a pattern in terms of what Garland is interested in. And with Civil War, I think people are so sort of caught up in the political whys of everything that they're kind of missing what it is that interests Garland based on The Beach, based on all of these other things that he's done. I think he's just interested in the way civilizations collapse and try to sort of rebuild in very flawed ways, and the human beings behind all those moments, I guess. I think it's an interesting movie if you kind of allow it, if you address Civil War, I think, on the terms in which the terms Alex Garland kind of gives you, I think you kind of have a better experience with it than if you kind of expect it to do something that he doesn't seem interested in doing. So that's my little rant about Civil War.
I think that's true. But to dig into the question here, I mean, yes, the conversation would be very, very different in this theoretical Anil posits.
Yes.
Because that's a radically different movie. It's not him addressing the moment that we're in. I mean, he has expressly said, I interviewed him about this and asked him, what's the agenda? People are mad because the agenda doesn't match what they thought it would be based solely on the idea of a movie taking place in the American Civil War. What is the actual agenda? And I mean, he does very much feel it's about present American politics, and it's about getting people to talk about what's worth fighting for and what would unite California and Texas, which has been a big sticking point for a lot of people talking about this movie.
Yeah.
If he was adapting somebody else's story, that alone, I think, would shift the conversation, because then the conversation would be about why this story, why now, why didn't he change these details? What did he add? What did he subtract? Mm. And that's a different conversation. If it took place in a fictional country, suddenly it stops being a case where people are looking for the metaphor for the now and, balancing for themselves whether it is a good metaphor for the now and in what ways and in what moments and in what characters. I think even just the process of adapting something shifts the conversation largely from why is this story the way it is, to why did you leave parts of this story or take parts of this story? And that just becomes, it just feels like there's a lot less blame generally around that kind of thing, and a lot more curiosity. And a lot of the conversations that I've read about this movie are just very, very angry at Alex Garland for the choices that he made here.
Yeah. Well, still, you know, one of the small handful of movies that have come out this year that are very thought-provoking still. So we have more feedback I think we'll share with you on a future episode. But for now, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730. Or you can send us a voice memo. That's kind of fun. So you can kind of just do various recordings of yourself to get it perfect. An email.
It's an audio medium.
Yeah,
people.
Baby. It's an audio medium. So you can record it. You can record it again. And then you can send it. Or you can just send an old-fashioned email to us.
And don't worry if you mess up. I'll cut out the bobbles. I'll make you sound good, I promise.
Yeah. You'll put it through. What's it called?
That's what I do.
Balance regulator. Or what the hell? What's that thing called?
Yes, I'll put it through regular.
What it is, whatever it is that you do that makes it sound good. So you can send that voice memo, or you can just send an old-fashioned email to us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for the Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll talk about Challengers before bringing E2 Mama Tambien back into the discussion. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, remember, if you play with babies, you end up washing diapers.